Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone. The views and opinions expressed are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder why a loving God can't bring peace to this earth. Well, human beings were created by God with free will. Free will. It is we who are responsible to bring about a better planet. But I have great news, wonderful news, fantastic news. I bring you great tidings of joy. Hillary Clinton, our Secretary of State, has announced, now hold on to your seats because this is just going to bowl you over. She has announced that the Israelis and Palestinians are going to sit down for more peace talks. Oh, happy days are here again. I'm sure it will be successful this time. After all, the Palestinians have proven how much they yearn to get along with Israel. Like the time Israel vacated Gaza so that they could have their own state, the Palestinians promptly burned down all those synagogues and then began firing rockets into Israel. Just their own kinky, nutty way of showing gratitude, I suppose. And the way they teach Palestinian kindergarteners how Israel has no right to even exist at all. It's not a two-state solution. They want a no-state solution. She has no right to exist at all. How fun when kids on television repeat that all Jews are devils. Art Linkletter was right. Kids say the darndest things. So who knows what kind of deal Hillary might offer to a people who are conditioned from the cradle for peace talks. Now I'm just thinking off the top of my head here. Perhaps the Israeli government can ship every single one of their citizens to Brooklyn, New York. Oh, wait, that will never work. Sooner or later, Muslims are going to claim that New York is their land also and that Jews are occupying it. Okay, well, try this one on for size. If the Jews get together as a nation in the tradition of Jim Jones Church in Guyana, drink poison Kool-Aid, and just die, then at long last, Jews and Palestinians can share the land in peace. You see, the Jews will be buried under the land, and the Palestinians can inhabit what's above. That ought to be peaceful. Kind of quiet, too. Anyway, those were just a couple of ideas. I'm sure Obama and Hillary can be even more creative than that. And remember, they aren't just doing this for the Middle East. They are thinking of the better interests of the United States. Once Israel is sold up the river, supposedly Muslims all over the world will love America once again. Remember, it's only because of Israel that jihadists came after us. Those commands in the Quran about conquering the world and killing all who refuse to convert to Islam are only an incredible coincidence. Speaking of Muslims and speaking of New York, I keep hearing about how unconstitutional it would be to not allow Muslims to build a mosque on the site of Ground Zero. I seldom hear the left excited about the same freedom for Christians. How much whining do we witness at Christmas time when manger scenes are displayed publicly? I know you don't have to tell me. I know there's a difference between private and public property. But since we are talking about the Constitution anyway, it actually does not forbid religious displays on public property. Just check out the Supreme Court building sometime if you don't believe me. Nevertheless, putting baby Jesus and Mother Mary aside for a moment, let's settle this mosque question before any more hot air wears our country out and people allow the worship building only to avoid further fatigue. Does our country guarantee freedom of religious expression to any and all religions, including the right to build a place of worship? Yes. Does our country allow a religion to promote the spreading of Sharia law, which would not only violate our Constitution, but would especially contradict the freedom of religion, First Amendment? No. And when the imam who would head this new mosque, Imam Faisal Abdul Ra'af, not only embraces Sharia law, but claims America was partly responsible for 9/11 and refuses to call Hamas a terrorist organization, we are no longer witnessing the fruit of religious expression, but rather an example of treason and sedition. Any questions? I mean, honestly, this should be easy. It isn't rocket science, but then when did logic, national security, or common sense ever have anything to do with political correctness? That would be a good question to ask the New York Times. Did you know that Obama would like to bail out the New York Times? I can't imagine why. Well, these are the words of Cheryl Gay Stolberg on August 14, 2010, for her op-ed piece in the New York Times. Ms. Stolberg says, and I quote, "From the moment he took the oath of office, using his entire name, Barack Hussein Obama, as he swore to protect and defend the Constitution, Mr. Obama has personified the hopes of many Americans about tolerance and inclusion. He has devoted himself to reaching out to the Muslim world, vowing, as he did in Cairo last year, a new beginning. But his new beginning has aroused nervousness in some, especially those who disagree with his counterterrorism policies or those more comfortable with a vision of America as a white and largely Christian nation and not the pluralistic melting pot Mr. Obama represents." Those were the words of Cheryl Stolberg. Ms. Stolberg, have you no shame? A top reason why those who believe Obama placates too much to the Muslim world is that we want to see an all-white Christian America. We don't believe in a melting pot. As it so happens, I'm a Jewish Democrat with a Sephardic-type complexion. At least my skin was dark enough that when I traveled to the East Coast only a few weeks after 9/11, I was immediately stopped and checked by security, probably because they mistook me for a Middle East resident. Now, I did convert to Christianity, and I do vote conservative on most issues, all the while maintaining a Democrat registration, but that only proves that I place conviction ahead of affiliation and honest beliefs ahead of racial religious background. I share this brief bio because you seem to need a little help with your stereotype-prone agenda. Allow me to open your mind to the possibility that some people are merely concerned about safety, even those of us who have read the Constitution. You talk about the Constitution as if the rest of us hadn't even heard of it. Offering diplomacy to cutthroats like Ahmadinejad and platitudes to America-hating countries like Egypt is viewed by our enemies as a sign of weakness. It emboldens the people who would destroy our Constitution. To be perfectly frank, President Obama made the United States less safe on his magical mystery apology tour and his far too frequent invitations to sit down and smoke a peace pipe with the Iranian dictator who wants genocide for Jews. Similar concern explains our opposition to this grand mural mosque and its proposed imam. We do not trust a cleric who will not renounce Hamas. Just what part of the word Hamas do you not understand? If that organization isn't a terrorist group, the word terrorist needs to be taken out of the dictionary. Neither do we find our president and his supporters like you quite as tolerant as they accuse the rest of us of not being. For example, how often have you seen mainstream conservative papers like the Wall Street Journal stoop to your style of name-calling when people disagree with their positions? Instead, they defend their point of view with facts. You, however, without offering a single fact, attempt to read the minds and motives of those who do not share your conclusions. You play the race card like a woman addicted to gin rummy. Do you really believe that most objections to this mosque come from a desire to have an all-white Christian nation? If you sincerely hold such an unfair, judgmental opinion, you are simply not qualified to be a journalist. If, on the other hand, you do not honestly embrace that idea, but made your thoughtless, irresponsible comment anyway, well, then that is even more important of a reason to disqualify you as a journalist. Incidentally, Ms. Stolberg, the true original concept of a melting pot was that those who migrate to America, regardless of color, regardless of culture, regardless of background, all melt together. That's why they call it a melting pot. They melt together by embracing American values as written in our Constitution, not Sharia law, which would dismantle our Constitution. Come, quickly. November, every day we get closer to November, I'm just a happier panda. We need to put some decent people in office, people who won't go to bed at nights worrying about what the New York Times editorial is going to say about them. One such person, hopefully, will be Bruce Brown, running for the House of Representatives for the seat currently occupied by the famous, or some would say infamous, Maxine Waters. Bruce is our guest today, and I will introduce him when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170, 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to our program. Bruce Brown is running against Maxine Waters in the 35th Congressional District for House of Representatives. Bruce's background, though, is not so much political, which should be a sigh of relief. I think people are getting tired of politicians. It's in the technical sales management. He's an expert in business strategy. He was a pioneer in cogeneration power development in the 70s as CEO of Biomas Power Incorporated, and has led successful venture capital and private placement efforts. He's also introduced several new products to the industrial and consumer markets. Bruce Brown, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Boy, if you defeat Maxine Waters, you're going to become my hero, sir. The only thing that could be better than that is Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, what we're planning on.
I'm ready to sing Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead from The Wizard of Oz, even though we're not talking about their death. We don't want anyone to quote us out of context, but Ding Dong, they're removed. That would be enough of a song for me. Well, co-hosting with me today is my friend Maureen Coddington of Cyber Video. I've had the privilege of running into Maureen at several tea parties now and interviewing her on the Rick Amato Show, but my own audience may also recognize her name as I've read many of her thought-provoking comments from Facebook over the air, and Maureen will have some questions of her own for Bruce Brown as well. Good to have you here, Maureen.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Okay. Well, Bruce Brown, I'd like to spend most of our time talking about you and your ideas rather than talking about your opponent, Maxine Waters, but first, Representative Waters is unavoidable. She does represent two big elephants in the room. So let's get these elephants out of the way one at a time. The first elephant. I'm going to sound like Johnny Carson. We come to the first elephant. Let's review for a moment the controversy involving Waters. And let me know if I'm leaving out anything important. As I understand it, she's a member of the House Financial Services Committee As a member, she asked our Treasury Secretary in September of 2008 to help the failing bank called One United Bank to help them get a government bailout, failing to mention that her husband owned One United shares worth about $350,000, and failing to mention that he had been on their board of directors until April of 2008. Is that correct? Or anything you want to add to that?
Well, it's as accurate as I've certainly heard. In terms of adding to it, that's the basic story, and then it's what she leaves out in the discussion that causes more eyebrows to be raised. Because you talk about the stock being worth $350,000, that's today's value. Before the bank was about to go into receivership, that stock was zero. So you hear her say quite often, well, we didn't benefit from it, nothing happened. Well, almost a third of $1 million in stock, I mean, resulted in value. The other thing she loves to talk about is her staff made all the calls.
Oh, of course.
But she rarely, it sounds so much different that my grandson made the call or taking care of grandpa. So there's a lot left out in the discussion.
Yeah.
And the third part that I don't think the media has done a good job of getting into is really looking at the bank itself, because she's tried to represent it as a minority-friendly bank, and they're helping people and doing great work. And yet less than 10% of the bank's portfolio is minority loans, and their Miami branch was actually cited for redlining.
No kidding.
So there's a lot more to be said about this that's not necessarily being covered well. But
I just love hearing about how it's the staff's fault. I think the staff have become the fall guys more than the CIA agents or Secret Service agents for the president these days. It's a more dangerous job. Now, how's her case progressing? Is she going to be going up before Senate committees, or is this thing going into an actual courtroom?
It's a House Ethics Committee. It's not a court committee. And I will be honest, I haven't spent a lot of time on the technical detail. So I'll give you an instinctive answer that I believe people who go running around, I demand a trial, are people that know there's not an imminent trial to be had.
Uh-huh.
So I think she knows that.
And she's been saying that. She's been demanding.
She's been saying, I demand a trial. She's been all over the media. And typically you do that when you know nobody's going to give you a trial. And the idea is it makes you sound like you're innocent. So in the context of how that happens, the ethics committee stuff is pretty closed door. But just based on what I hear through the grapevine, so to speak. Not a bad grapevine, but
now, has she played the race card yet? I kept hearing speculation. I don't know if I've actually heard that from her. Where she's saying this is because of
she's tried.
What did she actually say?
That this is a racist attack on the black community. I mean, she doesn't mince any words. This is racist, and that's pretty much her.
You know, 20 years ago, if I heard somebody accused of a racist, that would be quite a charge. Isn't that just greeted with a yawn now? Since isn't the definition of a racist anybody who wins an argument with a liberal?
I hate to say it, but to a lot of Republicans in Congress and a lot of representatives, they run from the racist charge. The racist charge scares them. The bigot, the zealot. You throw these charges out, just like you mentioned in your monologue about the idea of one side has no facts, so they simply, you know, make personal charges.
Yeah.
And we continue, we make our side, they call us racist. We make our side, they call us racist. Well, you do that for an hour, and you got a lot of racism in the air. But her modus operandi for 20 years has been if somebody in the district needed a place to live, she'd call an apartment owner racist. And it goes, yeah, we care, but nobody ever gets a house. And part of our upcoming program, I mean, it's going to show how the cry of racism has been so damaging to the community because it stops so much good work in its tracks. So the fact that the last 12 people charged with ethics violations are white, and the fact that 100% of the committee voted for the racism charge didn't fly. So, I mean, that's not going to work at all. Absolutely not.
Okay. Now, the other big Maxine Waters elephant is she has been, if I'm correct, representing California, first from the 29th Congressional District and later through the 35th. Since 1991, these seem to be strong, entrenched Democrat areas. And much as I would love to see you defeat her, some would say her seat is as safe as Pelosi's seat in San Francisco. So what kind of hope can you offer to our listeners to that defeatist attitude?
I can offer huge hope. I hope we have enough time. The first issue is that it's obvious that if you're outgunned in registration, and the registration difference is actually about 6-1. If you're outgunned in registration, the first thing you have to do is you have to take party out of the equation. So this race cannot be about Democrat versus Republican. And the way you take party out of the equation is that you have to have a message that is so much more powerful than your opponent that it transcends the norm. And the reality is, I view America as the second greatest story ever told. Your listeners may get that more than a lot of others do. And conservatism is the greatest governing philosophy in the history of the world. And if you don't think that you can win with these arguments, I mean, we beat the British Empire with freedom. So if you don't think you can win with these arguments, go home. And the second part is that 2 years ago, I literally threw away life as I knew it and said, I'm going into the minority community and I'm going to break the lock the Democrats have on that vote. And I jumped in to do it. So I have been in there hands-on for over 2 years doing gang intervention, teaching conservative theory, showing the disconnect between today's Democrat Party and religious principles in their life. And it didn't hit me till a radio interview a couple weeks ago where the come from the interviewer was, everybody in your district is on welfare. Why would they ever vote for somebody that thinks they ought to get a job? And it shocked me because I've seen firsthand the pain that these people live with, their desire for freedom, their desire for more for their lives and their families, and they're tired of government cheese. They're just tired of everything not working. And when you see that hunger and you offer the opportunity, free market systems, how the solutions work, they want to hear more. They want to hear a lot more. And we teach the Declaration of Independence. We teach the Constitution. And a very prominent African-American lady called a couple of weeks ago to one of the people who worked with me in doing this and said, you know, I'd like to take another look at this Constitution thing you guys keep talking about. And that's a big deal. So my view is I went in 2 years ago to lead this community to a better life. And the only kicker is that if you have a solution way over on one side and a problem way over on the other side, a quantum leap is never the solution. And where Republicans have not succeeded is that, let's say the solution is a job. Well, let's say your family and your community has been so totally destroyed by government philosophy or government policy that you don't have a chance to get from the problem to the solution. So what I understand and I'm able to articulate is the transition we need to get from where you are.
You need to straighten with a brace and not with a hammer.
Yes. Okay. And I mean, it's turning safety nets into trampolines. We talk about things like that. But I have the ability, because I've seen how the system doesn't work, I have the ability to articulate, I'll say, the right combination of public and private, the right combination of who I call them the grant eaters, the people that eat all the money, versus the volunteers. The model has revealed itself to me, so to speak. And the idea that we beat the British Empire and I can't beat Maxine Waters, just not acceptable to me. I'm sorry. And that is, unfortunately, a pathology of a lot of political thinking today.
Okay.
In that you're just not willing to fight.
Well, now, right now, 70% or 75%, actually, of California Republicans and 54% of voters not affiliated with any major party have an unfavorable opinion of Waters, and only 38% of Democrats approve of her. So on one hand, that sounds like good news, but I understand that that's California-wide. What is the polling like in this specific 35th district?
Depending on how you do it, and I don't believe an honest poll's ever been taken, and we're going to wait a little bit for the shock and awe that we have coming. Before we get too deeply in it. But the polls tend to want to say that a group of people like her. And I do hear people say, oh, Maxine Waters really cares. And if you take the way the left works, it's easy to instill in people that you care. And it's only when you're able to articulate that that care never translated into anything.
Do her constituents seem concerned about this bank scandal, or do they seem
not at all?
Not at all.
Not at
all. As long as they're getting their goodies.
Well, it's I'm gonna I'll stop you on that if you'll forgive me, because it isn't about the goodies. It literally, I mean, there's a contingency that works on the grants and stays alive and does all of that stuff, and as long as the system works, but she's not a big part of that system. That's really the city of LA.
Bruce, Maxine has been in her district with her congressional seat for 20 years. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So she has a huge amount of name recognition among the constituents in that area.
Mm-hmm.
What has she ever been seriously challenged in all of those 20 years until now?
Not at all. One other thing that's interesting, too, though, is that prior to 1990, that was as safe a Republican seat as it became a Democrat seat.
Oh, that's interesting. How did the demographics
shift? Well, it was the demographics. It was a result of the 1990 gerrymandering redistricting program. And if you look at the districts in L.A., I mean, they are convoluted beyond belief. I've got little communities carved out of my district and thrown over here, and the lines are all over the place. Some districts transcend three counties. So that's interesting, but it was predominantly a black district. And there really wasn't – it's a very unique situation that I still struggle to explain it. But the only answer I can give is that God put something on my heart 2 years ago to go do something, because it makes no logical sense to me to be doing it. And if I'm driving into gang territory, very dangerous situation, I argue with myself. But the car shows up, and I get out, and we do things. But it's – she's also a very tough lady, and I have been told by numerous people to, I mean, you know, be very careful, threatening, that kind of thing. So not even third-party people have stepped up to take her on. So it's been pretty much a given that they were just overwhelming force. But as the district has changed from predominant black to dominant Hispanic, opened a huge door for me to win, and that's the last piece of the puzzle in it. I have an opportunity in this campaign to lead two minority groups to conservative governing principles and happy, proud Americans. And that's what, by the time we get done, this campaign is going to be a tremendous benefit to the country with national recognition for winning on principles.
Bruce, one of the things that impressed me about you when I first spoke to you was that you're really working in your community on a grassroots level. You don't just pop in for an occasional photo op. I mean, you're in there as part of the community on a daily basis. So how does Maxine Waters handle that kind of aspect of her district?
It really, in terms of part of the reality is, and this has something to do with actually the definition of a congressperson's job, that I would really like to redefine, because if you believe in smaller government, your job shouldn't be sitting there cranking out bills you don't like all day long. So the reality is Congress people spend a lot of time in Washington and not in the district. And there's very little evidence of her that I can see really being in their hands on. That there's a lot of photo ops, there's a lot of pictures, there's a lot of showing up for things that happen going, I'm here. But in terms of actually helping kids get out of jail, sponsoring Christmas parties for kids, sponsoring car washes, I mean, just being in there, real boots on the ground, hands on, you don't see that. And this is what's come as a surprise to people that, I mean, I've got 2 years of solid, hard work, not in the media and no protest. I mean, fundamentally, their answer to everything is we have to protest. And even, I mean, I've helped a mom who was approached, I don't want to mention names in this scenario, but she was in a bad situation and they offered to protest for $500. And the difference is that spoils any chance of solving anything. So by going in and showing that conservatives do care, by going in and showing that getting things done is what conservatism is about, and being able to make things work that nobody thought could work.
Now, you mentioned that things were going to shift when it became more of an Hispanic district. Many today would say that the Democrats' position on illegal immigration would be more favorable to the Hispanic community. Are you finding that not to be the case, or is there just something you're doing that's cutting through all that?
Republicans make a huge mistake in only talking about the Hispanic community in the context of illegal immigration. And the fact of the matter is there's upwards of 50 million proud Hispanic Americans.
And they're very Catholic and very conservative. Many.
They're very conservative. They're very Catholic. And they are not in favor of illegal immigration. They know that the way this is all being handled and debated, they're being hurt, because I view the Democrat Party as saying to the illegals in their home country, go ahead and jump the fence and go hide and we'll come save you later. That's really what the Democrat Party is saying, in my view, and that causes 85% of America to discount the entire Latino Hispanic community. And if you really look at the community, Harvard, Yale, USC, UCLA, I'm sure San Diego, all have Hispanic alumni associations, doctors, lawyers. Hispanics have won more medals of valor in our military than any other ethnic group, and they get America. That's why they come here. And so the illegal immigration debate is really being driven by a media message that I really don't believe is valid, and it's being driven by a party that just turns everything into a fight to take political ground. It's a given we have got to have a secure border. You go into the Hispanic community, they will talk about a secure border. We're a nation of laws, and so we're talking about things. There really isn't anything to talk about. Secure the border, and if you're driving down the street, you don't have a driver's license, you don't know how to drive, you don't own the car, you don't have insurance. It's like if a cop pulls me over, I don't show a license, I can be in trouble. But the way this thing is being structured, you take that very scenario I described, you go like, oh, sorry, you're here illegally, fine. You don't need a license, you don't need insurance.
Yeah, it's insanity, but we've gotten there so gradually.
That I'm still in somewhat of a shock.
Well, I think the frog got boiled slowly instead of quickly, and that's why we're living in this insanity. I do want to point out that thanks in large measure to the Hispanic and the African-American communities, the very conservative Proposition 8 passed.
Absolutely.
And that's something you don't always hear a lot about.
It shows where their hearts are, and it also shows they vote their impression of pocketbook when it comes time to elected officials. And what we're going to prove over the next few weeks in the campaign is that we're going to basically lead the communities to get aligned with their total political thinking. And this is where, this is a political show, but you can't get around the fact that the leadership of this Democratic Party, to me, is a godless entity. And in all of the influence the pastors have in the minority communities have to be challenged, that you cannot support a godless entity. You just can't do it. And I think this is part of what the breakdown we're seeing across the country and the incredible drop in people's satisfaction. But taking God back in is an inspiration for people's lives. And in my view, I've heard it called the big G versus the little G, but you have God and you have government, and you can only worship one. And so these concepts are important. Extremely important to the human spirit, to being alive.
Yeah, and government has tried to take the place of God far too often throughout history with devastating results.
Not only God, but the family. The family is the bedrock of freedom. That's where kids learn morality. That's how seniors used to be taken care of. And we've seen a wholesale destruction of the family. You see the job finished in the African-American community. That family's gone. And part of the campaign is to discuss what it's going to take to put it back.
And what's funny
is family's critical.
You hear that slavery and Jim Crow laws were the reason for the breakdown of the family. But actually, if you go back to the 1950s, the African-American family was a much tighter two-parent family. So they're being a little disingenuous when they try to leapfrog back to Jim Crow laws were still around, but they go back to the slavery thing like it's a like it's a reparations kind of
deal. I think you're pretty safe taking anything they say and calling it disingenuous. I think you're pretty safe looking at everything in that way. But I think people would look as much, if you want to look at an event, a leadership deal made with President Johnson, that we will take care of everything you need on one condition, and that is the man cannot be in the House. And that's the fundamental deal, is that the man has been driven out of the African-American family, and it's a disaster. So I look at crime. I mean, I look at gangs. You look at education, 50% dropout rate, kids in prison. This is what families are there for, to keep these things from happening.
And when you think about the fact that to some politicians and some civil rights leaders, keeping the African-American community disenfranchised like that really works to their advantage. I mean, you talk about being disingenuous, that would write the book on it.
The case is incredibly strong, and again, we're going after these issues. We're going to take them head on because they're a root cause. I've got four examples of where Maxine's cry of racism has done tremendous harm. And I also believe very strongly that every time an African-American spokesman, and I'll never call him a leader, it's always a spokesman, but every time they say racism, they say, my people can't make it on their own, or my people can't make it without me, or my people can't make it at all. And hate to put this out in public, but I actually go to NAACP meetings and make a difference. And there was a discussion about how a study showed that teachers have lower expectations of African-American students and how that hurts the African-American students. And there's a case to be made that if all you talk about is the slavery and angst of the past instead of the glory of the freedom you have today. And this is another part of our leadership, and I know it may sound a little condescending at first, but you can't get around the fact that in 2010, there is an unlimited amount of freedom on the table for people to have, and there is so much in Black history to be proud of. And it makes much more sense to instill people, even back to what you talked about, what we would, you know, call days when there was a unified family and the dad was proud to work. I mean, how many times did we hear Larry Elder in L.A.? He, I don't know whether he came down here or not, but always talking about his dad and how hard he worked and how dedicated he was. And that's been destroyed. And so I think it makes much more sense to live your life with the positive viewpoint, the positive influences, and even if you have all that angst, again, God can fill that gap. And so I think between the combination of spirituality and faith combined with an awful lot of good stuff there, we can vitalize this community. It's not, it needs inspiration is what it needs. And this is the kind of leadership that I think is missing across the board in politics.
Bruce, 40% of your district is Hispanic, 40% is Black, and 20% are white. Is that correct?
It's actually hard to track in the district, but it's close enough.
Close enough. Okay, so you have three distinctive segments, pretty close in that ratio. What are the similar issues, or do you find yourself dealing with three diverse populations?
The beauty of freedom, the free enterprise system, and the American dream is that it appeals to Republicans, Democrats, vegetarians, the old, the young. Doesn't matter what your gender is. The fact of the matter is that the way America was designed to work appeals to everybody. So the issues are to create the maximum amount of opportunity for people to achieve to whatever level they want to achieve. So it's... there really is no secret sauce for each group, because we have an Asian community, a Latino community, a African American community, and a Caucasian community. Freedom covers it all. And so there really isn't, to me, a secret sauce to everyone. It does raise my brochure bill four times higher than other districts.
So what are the dominant concerns that you find since you're in your district on a daily basis and working there, what do you find are the paramount concerns and issues that come up most frequently?
There is no other issue but jobs right now. Because if you have no job, you have no hope for anything. Is that you can't feed your family, you can't take care of things, you can't even move out of L.A. And this is what is so insidious about the economic policy that's being shoved down our throat. But there is no other issue but jobs. But the next question always is, where do jobs come from? And jobs come from the free enterprise system. That's where they are. So it's not just a philosophical pie-in-the-sky idea of freedom. It's actually where success comes from. You turn the people in this country loose tomorrow, literally. I could pick up tomorrow, lay out some tax cuts, some ideas that would give smooth sailing into the future, unleash the creativity of the people of the United States. Millions and millions and millions of people can fix this country almost overnight, and we need to unleash that. So it's not a philosophical concept. It's reality.
Well, right now, we just had shocking statistics of 500,000 new jobless claims last week. I don't believe the jobless claims have gone down under 420,000 for at least a year.
Oh, well, that's all George Bush's fault.
Oh, I forgot.
Yeah, everything's George Bush's fault.
I forgot about that.
May well
possibly be our current
may well
administration.
Be because he didn't speak up enough.
And we've had a sustained unemployment of 9.5, which we all know is really significantly higher than that. The middle class is being destroyed. Home values have gone down. People don't have jobs. People are unemployment benefits are running out. I think this is a national emergency. And if you get into Congress, Bruce, what would your priorities be to fix that? And why is this administration, as much as they say that jobs, 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 they're not doing anything about it. In fact, their policies seem to be to destroy rather than create.
I don't think there's any seems to be about it. I think they are trying to destroy our capitalistic system.
At some point, you got to believe they're out to get you. You cannot, I have to admit, even I am shocked that a couple of trillion dollars created no jobs. I mean, you'd think even if government workers took that money and spent it, but.
And not only did it not create jobs, but it created turtle crossings across a freeway and stupid things like that.
It's nuts. It is just insane. But what we have seen is because they spent such an enormous amount of money. And my favorite Tea Party sign is this little 8-year-old girl with a picture of her dollhouse, and it says, "I'm $37,500 in debt, and all I own is my dollhouse." And it has failed so miserably that we may actually be able to put progressivism, or whatever you call it, and I do think we spend way too much time trying to find the exact name for what's doing us in.
Whatever it's called.
Whatever
I don't
it's
want
called.
It.
This has failed so badly because the other thing you got to remember is they've been selling utopia, that the underlying message that was so hard for conservatives to defeat is that the left and the Democrat Party was teaching utopia. You put us in charge and your house payments will be made and your car payments will be made and life is going to be wonderful. And it didn't happen.
Well, you know, the Ann Coulter theory is every 20 years or so, we need to put the Democrats in power again so people can remember what they're like and then get them out of power for another 20 years.
And I'm hoping in today's technical age that we can get it recorded digitally and we don't ever have to go through this again.
Unfortunately, I think every generation has to learn its lesson afresh. People never seem to learn from history.
This has been builded for 50, 60 years. They've infiltrated every institution in our country, and it's a big fight, but we're fighting the big lie. I mean, it's the biggest lie ever told that there is such a thing as a benevolent society that is actually willing to take care of people, and what you get instead is that you get a group of elites who are, in fact, plundering the people in the name of caring. That if you really back it up, you will see unbelievable amounts of money.
Folks, we're being influenced by Mordor. We need a few humble hobbits to make their way to Mount Doom and throw that ring in the pit already.
Yeah, that's looking pretty good, right? In fact, government without representation started to look pretty good again.
Well, now, you talk quite a bit about God. You've kind of woven that in and out of your conversation. Some people would panic, not me, obviously, with the nature of this show, but some people would say that God and politics don't belong together. They got nervous whenever George Bush talked about his relationship with God. Not as nervous when Obama talks about his, but because so there's a little bit of hypocrisy there. But what do you say when somebody says, I'm a little bit scared when you tell me that God was leading me to run for this election? What do you say to that?
I think the only thing you can say to that is, let me help you be less scared, because the only reason to be scared is you probably don't know much about it. I tend to think they're more annoyed than scared, because they know the power of your argument and they know they have no answer for it. So I think it's got a lot more to do with a defense mechanism, because they know in the end it'll beat them, than it really is a fear. I think the fear is in the part of conservatives or Republicans who don't have the grounding in the principles.
Well, and the thing people don't stop to think about, they never look at this philosophically, and I guess that's understandable because people get bored to death in philosophy classes. But if there is no God and we're here by randomness and chance, then there's no such thing as human rights. There's no such thing as right and wrong, because right and wrong becomes very arbitrary and subjective. You could say you believe something to be right, and I could say, well, you're just an accident. You're just a lot of slop that accidentally evolved. Is one accident to another? I disagree. There's no God. There's no timing. So the whole premise, our founding document, the Declaration of Independence, was founded upon the idea that we're all created equal. And we want to hold on to the equal word, and we want to throw out the created word. And there can be none of these rights that everybody's talking about if there were no God.
No, it's, you only have two choices. You have rights from nature's God or Grover Cleveland. Those are your two choices. And it fundamentally, for me, the one thing I can't figure out with atheists is, if ever there was a question in life you don't want to get wrong, it's this one. And I deal with a lot of smart people who've used their intelligence to deny God. And I ask them some very simple questions. Have you ever used your intelligence to find him? Because, I mean, history is full of exceptionally intelligent people.
Well, it's often the difference between knowledge and wisdom. There's a lot of knowledge today and very little wisdom.
Wisdom is sorely missing. That's why I go back to the Declaration of Independence, and we hold these truths to be self-evident. You take the mosque situation in New York. The answer is no. And yes, it is unconstitutional to say you can't build a mosque, but it's not unconstitutional to say this is hallowed ground to the history of our country and our freedom. Three battlefields from the Civil War have been unanimously protected, with no one is allowed to put their label on anything near these properties.
And you can't get together in your mosque and plot on how to overthrow the infidel and put in Sharia law. The Constitution doesn't allow you to overthrow the Constitution. We call that revolution. If someone wants to start a revolution, try to overthrow our Constitution, then admit that you're starting a revolution. Don't pretend that you love this document that you want to shred the minute you get into power.
Now, it's the Constitution is not a suicide pact, and I say to all the Marxist people are of that ilk, you're in the wrong country, because when I grew up, Lenny Bruce was being persecuted, and he had a great line. Actually, I'm not going to go there. It's just the idea that if you really believe in Marxism, what are you doing in America? I mean, it just makes no sense to be a Marxist in this country.
But
living under
capitalism. We seem to have a Marxist for president now. What is your comment on that?
He's something. And again, we spend way too much time trying to figure out what. It's like if I were a San Diego Charger and I found the New England Patriot playbook and I ran some of the plays, that doesn't make me a New England Patriot, but we know the outcome. So we know where this is going.
Well, and if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. I agree. There's a point where we say, who cares what we call it?
Yeah.
But Obama's notorious for doing things and then coming on television the next day and explaining to all of us that he didn't really do what we thought he did.
Yeah.
After he took over the banks, he got up and said, no, I'm not a believer in big government. How does he say that with a straight face? Because people are just that stupid and they believe him.
Well, he's reading it, which helps. You can read just about anything with a straight face. So if you're simply reading the teleprompter, it's very easy to keep a straight face. But fundamentally, this thing is crashing and burning badly. And if there were enough seats in the Senate up, the problem with the Senate this year is that the way the historical one-third, one-third, one-third is split, this year is dominant Republican races. 2012, it reverses. And it's like 18 Democrats at risk in 2012. But the wheels are coming off. this situation because he's not even good at being whatever he is.
Well, now let's see.
He's not even pulling that off.
Well, assuming we take back the House, which would help, and if we took back, even if we took back the Senate, which doesn't seem as likely to some, with Obama and his czars and all these things we're hearing about executive orders, couldn't he just try to bypass Congress anyway?
Yes.
Between that and our bleeding heart judges with their judicial activism, I mean, I know we need to take back Congress this fall, but I've also, assuming we're going to take it back, it's kind of a healthy skepticism about the fact that we really shouldn't be breathing too big a sigh of a relief.
We have to. Failure is not an option on this one. If we do not get this thing stopped in 2010,
it's our last window.
It is the last battleground before shots fired, and I have great belief in the American people. I believe they get it, and I believe we're going to get it done. And again, we need to be talking about putting this Democrat leadership on a scrap heap of history. And all Republicans in Congress are talking about is eking out a majority. It is a difficulty that they don't seem interested in just going out and competing. I mean, really competing, how do we win across the board?
One of the impressions that I've had of the Republican Party the last few years is they seem quite content to just take the back seat and let things go along as usual. And that's been one of the major problems and a major cause of dissatisfaction among Republican voters.
I have said many times, if I were in Washington, I would have duct taped Arlen Specker to the back of a van and he'd never made it to the floor to cast a deciding vote. And until we want our freedom that badly, that's what it's going to take. And there's every new freshman congressman I know is very conservative, very grounded in all the principles we need grounded in, and there's going to be some butt kicked in Washington, no question about it. We have got to tear that thing apart.
Now, so say we take back the Congress and the economy gets fixed 2 years from now. Obviously, if it goes well, Obama takes all the credit. If it doesn't go well, he blames it on the fact that he had a Republican Congress. How do we counter that?
If you had to choose... Remember Reagan's old expression, there's no telling how much you can get done if you don't care who gets the credit. In this case, the only credit Obama could get was to go on vacation and stay there. I have no objection.
I have no problem with him going on vacation at all.
It's the coming back that's costing us trillions
of
dollars.
When he's in the White House, he thinks about things, and that's what gets dangerous.
Go on vacation. I'd just assume the missus wasn't hanging out with potential Bilderberger interfaces, but cut, please.
So, Bruce, aside from jobs, which, of course, I think we all agree is the most critical thing because everything is tied into jobs and employment, what other issues, not necessarily in any given order, would you think is also worth addressing immediately?
Things that distinguish you from Maxine Waters.
It's hard to boil the
day you put your foot into Congress, what is going to be on your to-do list?
Well, there's two overt things that we have got to get into government. One is gap accounting. That's generally accepted accounting principles. Every business in the country knows gap accounting, and you cannot hide things. That's why business is required to use it. And until this country gets on gap accounting, until it gets on dynamic economic modeling, there's no point in trying to fix anything because it's not fixable. Now, that said, the next thing we have to do is we have to start tearing the federal government down brick by brick, piece by piece. And, I mean, I'm willing to go back to 1776 in Washington. You have got to get the weight of the federal government off people's backs.
Yeah, I'm ready for Big Brother to become little second nephew.
It is a weight everybody carries. It's just like put 50 pounds in a backpack and walk around with it all day. That's your federal government.
Bruce, I know that you're a fiscal conservative. Would you also call yourself a social conservative?
Absolutely. To me, there's only one kind of conservative. And the thing people don't realize in the social fights is that we are confronted on the social issues to destroy us. And the end result of the left's attacks on the social issues and the things we believe in is Al Franken in the Senate. Their end game is cheating at the ballot box. It's not It's not about abortion. It's about destroying our society. And to not fight these fights is unconscionable. It's that we're fighting them poorly. And the media, because their messaging has been so dominant, that it's been very hard for our side to get their message out. And this is one of the reasons I jumped into the political arena. And I won't say politics, but 2 years ago, I was just sitting there listening to John McCain, and I just was like a ton of bricks. I just said, that's it. I can't take this anymore. You don't know how to talk. You don't know how to articulate. You don't know how to fight. I'm going in. And it's the fact that we lose them that is so disappointing. But for the big money fiscal people to blame socials, it's so dead wrong. It's scary. And any of them only need to spend a few minutes with me to understand that our victory will come with victory in the social issues.
Okay, Bruce Brown running for the 35th district. We could have somebody other than Maxine Waters. Bruce, what a pleasure to have you on our show. I hope you'll come back again after you get elected and celebrate with us. Maureen, we make a great team.
Yes,
come co-host with me again sometime. And I have to just say one thing about Al Franken before we go. He was hilarious on Saturday Night Live. He's not as funny in the White House. It's a funny, but it's another kind of funny. It's an embarrassing funny. It's a destructive funny. We'll see you next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ.
I know you may have recently lost money in the stock market. You may be dissatisfied.